Is it safe to cool off in your favorite swimming hole in, say, a creek along the bay or in a deep pool in a nearby river? Rona Cabell of the Chesapeake Bay Journal joins us this hour with some insights on the conditions of local swimming holes during the summer. Also in this month's edition of Midday on the Bay, the slaughter of an unloved Chesapeake native, the Cow-Nose Ray, raises a question about what is sport and what is depravity, and highlights the need for more information about the ray's impact on bay oysters. And speaking of oysters, we'll meet a young man who's raising them, and we'll hear from an older guy who's trying to kayak the entire Delmarva Peninsula in 30 days. Midday on the Bay with Rona Cabell after the news. And welcome back to Midday, everyone. Our second hour, 410-662-8780 is the phone number for live talk in this hour. This is the hour we devote once a month to talking about things, environmental things, Chesapeake with Rona Cabell, the Chesapeake Bay Journal. We call this show Midday on the Bay. It's done in collaboration with the Bay Journal. And Rona Cabell voted or named recently Best Bay Watcher by Baltimore Magazine, which is pretty nice recognition for you.
Yes.
Way to go, Rona.
Well, thank you. And we should add that you were named best columnist.
No, don't feel obligated to say that. That's a very nice thing for them to say. But anyway, I'm glad to see you get that recognition because you do a lot of hard work for the Bay Journal and then join us once a month for these data dumps that you give us. Yes. Rona has so many stories to cover in this hour of the show. So the first segment is sort of like environmental news. We got a few things to talk about, including a story that I'm really interested in. It has to do with a fish, sort of an unloved Chesapeake native called the Cow-Nose Ray. The word slaughter was used by an animal rights group to describe an event that took place in June where bow hunters on boats went out, I think it was the Patuxent River?
Yes.
Down there some near the mouth and killed a whole lot of these rays, and it raised questions about whether this kind of activity is actually sport or it's just, you know, bloodlust. What's the point of it all? And why is it a controversy? We'll talk about that during this hour of the show. We're going to meet a young oyster farmer, a Gilman School graduate who turned to oyster farming, right?
Yes. Yes. It's a great story about a left turn in life.
Okay. We're going to do that. That's a little bit later on. His name is Chris Hudson?
Patrick Hudson.
Patrick Hudson. So he'll be here in a little while. And Don Baugh is going to be on the phone. B-A-U-G-H.
Right.
Don
yes.
Baugh, who used to be with the Chesapeake Bay Foundation, right?
Yes. Many people, thousands of people probably went through Don Baugh's education programs at Chesapeake Bay Foundation, where he took them out and gave them a bay experience. And he left and he started his own nonprofit. And he, at age 61, is going to be circumnavigating the Delmarva Peninsula in 30 days. So that's 30 days of probably no bed to sleep in and outdoors all the time.
That's all the way around the Delmarva Peninsula.
All the way.
And he's going to do it in 30 days?
30 days,
Has
yes.
he started yet?
No, it starts, I think, at the end of August or September.
Okay.
He's going to start.
So we'll get Don on the phone before the hour's up to talk about his trip coming up.
And you and I are both invited along, Dan.
Oh, really?
If you want to paddle for
30 days?
30 miles a day. I don't know if I'm up for it.
We're also going to talk about swimming holes.
Yes.
Popular swimming holes, and are they safe to swim in? But let's start with power plants. So we're going
right.
to start with power plants. We'll get to the Cow-Nose Ray in a minute, talk about the Chesapeake Bay crab harvest and how that's going. But let's start with the clean power rules for power plants in Maryland.
Right. So President Obama introduced this new clean power rule that will require a 32% reduction in carbon dioxide by 2030. And predictably, the politicos all kind of went to their sides. And the Republicans said this is going to cost working families more money. And the Democrats said, you know, this is great because we need clean air. And really, Dan, this sounds maybe like a big deal. But it actually doesn't go as far as a lot of people think, because we're already doing a lot of the things that the Clean Power Rule suggests that we do. Obama backdated it to 2005, and so we've already made at least half of the reductions. And, you know, many states are already phasing out coal. Maryland is moving to natural gas. A lot of the power plants in the Midwest are already nuclear plants, which have their own issues, but certainly emit less less emissions. So we're really already well on our way to meeting the goals of this clean power rule.
Hundreds of power plants have closed.
Absolutely.
Coal-fired power plants.
Yes, and the ones that haven't have been required to replace the old technology with scrubbers and with new devices that burn much cleaner.
The claim in Maryland was that Maryland's effort isn't going far enough. The state isn't going far enough in addressing smog.
Right. Well, there was a kind of a rollback of a regulation that the O'Malley administration had put in place. And when Hogan came into office, among other things, including the phosphorus rule, he stopped these emergency regulations. And one of them was a reduction on smog. And as a result of that, there have been a couple lawsuits which are still pending. So we'll see where that goes. But there is a lot of pressure in Maryland to focus on clean air. We have one of the highest asthma rates in the country in Baltimore. We have a lot of code red days in the summer. And obviously, clean air is very important. And it's an important constituency, no matter whether you're Republican or Democrat or where you sit. So I have a feeling that at the end of the day, we are going to get closer to the rules that O'Malley introduced.
That reaction to Obama's order was because he had pushed the clock up. I mean, you say he started implementation earlier. He backclocked it a little bit, but he actually pushed the clock up on it, right? They have to comply a little sooner than they had expected.
Right, except that, like I said, they're already kind of halfway
doing
there.
It, right.
Yeah, so if he had said, you know, you need a 50% reduction by 2030 starting now, that would have been fairly difficult for the states to meet. But he did it in such a way that most states are pretty well on track to meet this, and it won't be that difficult or that expensive for them to get there. And that's largely because the free market is taking care of that, with natural gas being cheap and so much cleaner.
So, okay, so it's not the calamity Republicans are claiming, in your view?
No, yeah. Nor the success that Democrats are claiming.
Now, I see the word slaughter or massacre used to describe what happened with some cow nose rays in the Bay in June. So let's talk about this animal a little bit first, and then we'll get to the controversy.
The cow nose ray is a very beautiful, majestic animal. I kind of think of it as the hawk of the sea. It has a very wide, kite-like wingspan, and they come into the bay in June, and they have babies around then, and then they leave in September or October, and we're not entirely sure where they go, but we think it's mainly Florida. And these are not animals that have much of a market. They don't taste very good. They're hard to cook. Not too many chefs want to deal with them, but they are a nuisance in a lot of watermen's eyes because they eat razor clams and oysters and bait fish. And so a lot of fishermen would like to see them gone.
A lot of the watermen, especially the oystermen, right?
Yes. And particularly some of the oyster farms down in Southern Maryland and Virginia, these rays can just get into the oyster farms if the oysters aren't protected in cages and just chomp their way through the farm. So they're considered by many to be a nuisance. And so a few years ago, actually about 20 years ago, a guy started bow fishing tournaments, and they were kind of quiet. We didn't really know much about them until last year when it became known that they were doing this, and a video surfaced just this past June of a massive slaughter of the cow nose rays with the bowfish.
And do you consider those terms exaggeration at all?
If you watch the video, which is quite disturbing,
yeah.
I would not. I mean,
because it looked like they were killing every ray they caught.
Right.
Caught isn't the word, is it really? I guess it is because you have a bow at the bow of the boat and you fire your bow into the ray, the fairly easy target to hit.
Yes.
And then you pull them in. I guess that's a form of fishing, but it is. It's a popular type of sport now. Bow hunting. Bow hunters are out looking for snakehead too.
Right.
Anyway, so they killed them all. It looked like to me they didn't return any of them. And this video of them beating the rays into unconsciousness, killing them with a baseball bat, small bats or something, and then weighing them because I guess there was a prize for the heaviest one, right?
Right. And what was, I think, the most disturbing thing as a mother is the rays were pregnant and they were trying to have their babies and the babies were trying to come out. and the bow fishermen were pushing the babies back into the ray because
so they'd weigh more,
right? Yeah. So this was extremely difficult to watch. You don't have to be an animal lover, I don't think, to cringe as you watch something like that. But on the other hand, it was perfectly legal what they did, and there is this perception out there that rays are a menace and that there are too many of them, and so they're. It created this kerfuffle, I guess, because the animal rights groups began saying we need to stop this. And the fisheries managers in both Maryland and Virginia were kind of caught off guard because they weren't they don't have a plan in either state to manage the rays. And they're not really sure the behavior of the rays. We haven't studied the ray that extensively, so they didn't really know what to do. And so right now, both states are kind of scrambling to put together some kind of a plan so that we know where these rays go.
So we know what we're doing?
So we know what we're doing, right. And
okay.
So,
we have a tournament where you just kill every ray, especially pregnant rays, in a certain time of the year, you're not doing some kind of damage to the natural balance, if there even is a natural balance anymore. I mean, it occurs to me while you're talking that we're talking about people who are out trying to harvest seafood for us, right? Oysters, clams, I guess baked clams, and then there's this animal that comes in that needs to eat those things, right, while it's having its babies in the Chesapeake Bay. But because man has an interest in the other marketable creatures, such as the oysters, we've got to kill off these rays that have been around for centuries, probably? Right.
Right. And unlike the snakehead, which I have gone bow fishing for snakehead, the ray is a native animal to the Chesapeake Bay. It comes back every year. It is it may be high up in the food chain and that it doesn't have any predators, but does that mean that we should eat it? And the other thing to note, Dan, about the oysters and the razor clams is it's long been the perception, and it is true, especially on an oyster farm where you have a lot of oysters just lying on the bottom for the taking for a ray. Mm-hmm. But in the study that the Virginia Institute of Marine Science did about rays, they examined the stomachs of the rays, and they found that only one had an oyster in it.
From my reading of it, they'll eat small oysters.
Right.
They prefer soft shellfish over the hard shell oyster.
They do,
and they have a hard time eating the larger oysters.
That's right.
They actually don't eat the larger oysters. So okay, so where is this whole thing left? I checked with the Department of Natural Resources today, and there's no limit on the catch of cow nose. I mean, they're just not protected.
Well, right now they're trying to mull what to do, because what they don't want to do is have kind of a knee-jerk reaction to this terrible video of what happened. And there is a constituency for bow fishing in both states. There are people who enjoy it. There are charter boat fishermen who make their living taking people out. And it isn't, I mean, the tournament was kind of a huge wake-up call. But I think charter boat fishermen have quietly been taking people out bow fishing for all kinds of things as restrictions on other fish have tightened. So you can't keep, I don't know how many striped bass you can keep if you go out fishing for striped bass, but
yeah, there are limits.
There are limits. And it would be more fun, I think, to go out and get as many snakeheads as you could, or, if that's something you enjoy. So I think you have to sort of balance the desires and the needs of the recreational fishermen with this desire and the need to protect the ray. And at the same time, I think one thing that was really troubling to a lot of people is that these rays just went to the garbage. They became crab bait for watermen, or in some cases they became an amendment to the soil for farmers, but they didn't get eaten by humans.
And again, that's because there's no market for them. It's a tricky market, right?
It's a tricky market.
You have to know how to fillet them and remove certain parts of them, otherwise you get this urine flavor in the meat.
Exactly.
But it is possible to fillet them in a way that they are edible and delicious, apparently, according to some bow hunters who reported I think it was on the DNR website.
Well, one of the people I talked to, Martin Gary, he's the head of the Potomac River Fisheries Commission. He says, a terrific meal at this restaurant down in Virginia called Miroir, and the chef swears that it was cow nose ray. And the secret to it, according to Marty, who talked to the chef, is that when the ray is processed by a professional seafood processor, the cut of the ray is thin enough and the ray is soaked in enough different processes that you can get rid of the taste and you can make it like a really nice flavor. But if someone handed me a Ray, I wouldn't be able to do that as a home chef. I'd probably end up with something that tasted pretty much like urine.
Right. Right.
So
interesting. So Rona, one more thing we want to talk about when it comes to the Chesapeake Bay and the resource, crabs. I had a note in my column the other day, quoting a few people saying that the crab harvest looks better this year, certainly better than it was last year.
Well, that's probably in part due to the weather, because of the it got warmer a little bit later. But yeah, I mean, the thing about crabs is crabs are so mercurial. They if you look at the historic data, the harvest just swings so wildly. And so it's, I don't know how indicative it is of anything, you know, when it's good or when it's bad. I mean, what tells you much more, I think, is when they do the winter dredge survey and they count the crabs.
Now, the winter dredge survey this year indicated it might be a good season.
Lots of small ones.
Right. So there were a lot of small ones in the spring, but apparently over the last 2 or 3 months, they've grown quite a bit. And there's some larger crabs being caught now.
Yes, which, I mean, it's all to the good. And, I mean, I know you're not eating crabs, right? Are you?
I thought I'd give it another year, see how they come back. Because we've had so many years of complete exploitation and near collapse.
Right.
I support a moratorium. I don't understand why we just don't give the crabs a year off. I do understand the argument against it. It's been explained to me a couple of times by Brenda Davis, who's in charge of the Blue Crab Program. For the state, she's done a very good job explaining that. We've just discussed it on the air here, but it's still instinctually, it seems to me, that if you have a fully exploited resource and you can give watermen something else to do for a year, it might be worth a year just to back off and see how, you know, if the population really comes back strong so we can stop worrying about this over time. But you know from your own research that a lot of this turns on the weather. And other conditions around the bay.
And habitat is a big part of it.
And habitat, right.
And the quality of the water. And
That is actually the main thing, more than weather even.
Yeah. And temperature of the water is a big thing too. I mean, because they're coming back and they're riding the currents from the ocean back to the bay. And changes in temperature of the water can affect the current, even by a degree or two, to make them, you know, not come or come a little slower. And so there are so many factors involved in year to year how the crabs are.
How safe is it? How safe is your favorite swimming hole? When we come back here after our break here, first break on Midday on the Bay with Rona Cabell, we'll talk about what testing shows in terms of water quality, bacteria, and some very popular swimming holes around the Chesapeake Bay. And then a bit later on, we'll talk to a young oyster farmer, and we'll hear from a slightly older guy who's trying to kayak the entire Delmarva Peninsula in 30 days. So please stay with us. On the cow nose ray, I just can't kill something for the sake of killing it. Right?
Especially when it's pregnant.
All that. And I mean, if you said there's too many of these things, right, and it's really upset the balance because we're trying to trying to catch the marketable creatures in the bay, the oysters and clams, right? So, but I don't know. I don't know if I could do it. Alice wrote in, say, is there a predator to the rays? My reading shows that the shark seems to be the main predator.
But there's not as many sharks in the bay as there used to be.
Right. But the cow nose does leave the bay, right?
Right.
Where it becomes vulnerable to shark attack, right?
Yes.
If so, has it been depleted? If this is the case, I can understand a hunting season on them, much as we have for deer, to keep down overpopulation. But as Rona was saying before, there just hasn't been enough research to show whether you need to do that or not.
Right, and because they only give one live birth a year, if you do overfish them, you're unlikely to get them back.
Correct. Moving on in this segment of Midday on the Bay to water quality, particularly swimming holes, popular swimming holes. What's all this about, Rona? Somebody's doing testing of waters?
Yes, the Chesapeake Bay Foundation partnered with three community colleges, well, Hood College in Frederick and then the community colleges in Hartford and Howard counties, to test popular swimming holes. And the reason they decided to do this is because the EPA requires states to test beaches, but they don't require states to test every single place where people swim. And just Chesapeake Bay Foundation thought there might be some holes, and they thought this might be a good way to teach people that stormwater and what we do on the land affects how we swim. So the big finding was that the Kilgore Falls waterfall in Harford County in Rock State Park had 50 times higher than what the EPA says is acceptable for swimming. And
50% higher bacteria.
50 times higher fecal coliform bacteria. So, and it's a popular place to swim and to hike. It's the waterfall that was immortalized in the Tuck Everlasting movie. And
I remember talking about it with you.
Yeah, it's lovely. And the children of Harford County actually saved their pennies to save the waterfall because it was going to be privately developed. So it's a cherished place, but probably not a place where you want to swim after a rain.
Okay, so that's coming from farmland? Where is that coming from?
It's coming from runoff from stormwater, largely. There are some farms.
But I mean stormwater from farms? Is that where you get the cola from?
And urban, you know, urban stuff. I mean, just
septic systems that don't work very well?
Exactly, yes, yes.
It all floods into the tributary that leads to the falls?
Yes. So,
Did they test other places?
They did. They tested a place in Harford County, Glade Run. I mean, Frederick County, Glade Run. And then they tested the Columbia Lakes, which did better than you might have thought. But they did have high bacteria counts after a rain. And this is some advice that I have been given and sometimes don't follow. But you're not supposed to go in the water 48 to 72 hours after a rain because of the high bacteria counts. Because of my job, I sometimes cannot avoid it. So I do go in and I've been okay thus far, but there are risks to it. And, you know, we've talked on the show before about the flesh-eating bacteria, Vibrio, and people losing legs. And I just want to reassure listeners that, you know, that's very unlikely to happen if you go in the water after a rain. But some of the other things that could happen and do happen are diarrhea, giardia, upset stomach, ear infections, different kinds of things that can happen when you have contact with the water. And so we need to be aware that it isn't that safe to go in after it rains. And you know, some people follow that rule very closely, but other people, if it's not raining, they swim. One of the counties that's been very good about monitoring this and filling in the gaps where the state and the EPA don't require it is Anne Arundel County. They have a very good, robust county monitoring program. They have lots of beaches, and then many of the private associations on the Severn and Magathy River have hired Sally Horner, who is a professor of biology at Anne Arundel Community College, to do testing. And Horner tests twice a week at the major beaches in the county, and she has a website called Operation Clearwater. And people can go on the website and they can see what the counts are. The riverkeepers in Anne Arundel County and elsewhere also do this, but if there's a popular swimming hole that's kind of unmarked, you're probably not going to know whether or not it's safe to swim. It's just, and you can't just assume that it is because the government didn't put up a sign. Mm-hmm. That's the problem.
And because you've always gone there.
And because you've always gone there. I mean, there's been a lot of changes. I mean, we're getting much more severe storms than we used to. Watersheds are much more developed than they used to be. So the swimming hole that 30 years ago was perfectly safe might not be today.
Did you see the column I wrote about fishing in the Inner Harbor?
I did.
And the question, are you going to eat that, comes up, right? Now, There's rockfish in the Inner Harbor. And I wrote about myself and other people having more luck than I am, catching 20-inch, 22-inch rockfish right up, you know, in the Inner Harbor of Baltimore. So you said you wanted to talk about that for a minute. We will just for a moment. I haven't eaten one yet, but I know that people have come down and taken fish away from some of the other fishermen I know to go off and eat them. Well, and I did a little research on that. So what did you want to say about it?
Well, would you eat one? Would you eat a rockfish caught in the harbor?
Yeah.
You would?
Yeah. Yeah, and I'm working my way toward catching one that's legal size and actually going to clean it and eat it because it's a migratory fish. I don't think it spends the whole year. It's not a bottom feeding fish all year in the Inner Harbor. And I'm not worried about it.
Well, you're not going to get pregnant. You're probably safe.
Right. Well, so if I was a pregnant woman, you would say, no, don't eat anything from the harbor at all at any time. I can understand not eating a catfish, maybe. But what about a migratory fish such as the rockfish?
I think if you're pregnant, I wouldn't eat anything from the inner harbor. And the reason is because, you know, there's a lot of things going on in the inner harbor. There's a lot of infrastructure underneath it. There are pipes. I don't know. I feel like it troubles me when I see people fishing over the Hanover Street Bridge. And I know they're probably eating what they catch because there's so many unknowns about those fish. And they're eating, I mean, they're consuming water that isn't clean from all sorts of sources of bacteria, sewage, stormwater, leaky infrastructure, gas.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I mean,
but you know, the state puts out an advisory on this. Do you know? You know that they
yes.
put out advisories on all sorts of bodies of water around the state, how much fish to eat from there, and it's pregnant women are distinguished from sustenance fishermen, males, females, right?
Right.
It's all done. You can find all that information on the DNR website. But they don't say, no, don't eat anything from the Hanover Street area, Poteet Street.
They used to tell people not to eat the mustard of the crabs, mm-hmm. that if you're going to catch a crab, don't eat the inside, because that's the part that's most likely to get the contamination.
And there's a specific advisory and a video, instructive video, on how to clean a rockfish so that you eliminate the parts that where PCBs, for instance, or the heavy metals may settle in the system of the fish. But a couple of years ago, the state reported an improvement in contamination of rockfish and raised the number that you can eat in a certain 30-day period.
I just would...
I understand the reluctance to do that.
It's a personal decision, I think. I mean, you know,
I'm not so sure it would be so bad, a one shot. You know, how many times a year am I going to do this? Maybe once a year.
Yeah, I'm sure you'll be fine, Dan.
Yeah, I don't know. But you're saying I'm pushing the clock up. The bay isn't ready. The inner harbor isn't ready for us to be eating fish that
you're
swim
talking,
through there.
You're talking to someone who went flo-yo stand-up paddle boarding in Dundalk's most polluted creek a couple months ago just after a rainstorm and right before another one started. So I'm not above taking risks every so often.
But you were standing actually on the water. You actually weren't touching it very much.
I fell in.
Oh,
I
you did?
Fall
okay.
in, and I had a metal taste in my mouth for about 2 weeks afterwards.
Oh, really?
So, you know, I'm not saying, like, I think you need to live your life and enjoy your life and push the envelope a little bit, but I personally would draw the line at eating a rockfish from the harbor.
Okay. It remains to be seen whether I do it or not. A lot of talk here. Don Baugh is going to join us now. Don Baugh, former Bay Foundation, Chesapeake Bay Foundation outdoor educator, going on a trip in a kayak. And we thought we'd talk with him for a few minutes. Don Baugh, thank you for joining us here on the Midday Show.
Yeah, thanks, Dan. It seems very appropriate to follow up Verona's comments about living your life, enjoying your life, and pushing the envelope a little bit.
Yeah. So, Don, you're going to take on the circumnavigation of the Delmarva Peninsula, and you've done this before, right?
I have. I did it 10 years ago with my colleague, Tom Horton.
And you and Tom are setting out on the same trip this year.
We are. It's a bit different this time. You know, it's interesting because we've got a couple things going on. One is, you know, 10 years later, we're looking at what's changed. You know, we've got a pretty good benchmark of seeing it in a very close-up way. But, you know, we're expecting some pretty significant changes, some good, some bad. So on one hand, it's a sense of discovery. But it's also it's an opportunity for us as we get a little older in our careers as environmental leaders to give back to the next generation. So we've invited the next generation along with us on the trip and looking for ways to figure out how to pass the baton to them along the way.
So who will be joining you? Who will be joining you and Tom Horton?
We've got a guy and a gal, Stephen Aaron, who lives in Durham, North Carolina. He started an outdoor supply company, and he also runs a bicycle-powered composting company. He collects compost waste by bicycle in the city of Durham. So he's a really interesting entrepreneurial kind of part of this new green economy. And then he's 25 years old.
Excuse me, Don, can I just stop you for a moment? The bicycle composting? I'm not familiar with that. Would you mind describing that for a moment?
You know, I mean, obviously composting is catching on in a lot of places. It's wonderful that, you know, sometimes, you know, know, the municipalities will provide that service. In some cases, they don't. In the case of Durham, an entrepreneurial company is going around and collecting the compost from businesses and being paid to do that, and then taking them back to the municipal sites. But they do that by bicycle-powered. So you see, you know, people in cities, you know, carrying tourists around. So instead of a couple tourists, you're carrying a a trailer of compost.
Oh, okay, using a bicycle. Okay.
Yeah.
So this, what's this fellow's name again?
Stephen Aaron.
Stephen Aaron. So he and his wife are joining you?
No. And the gal coming along is Alex Crooks. And Alex grew up in Annapolis. She's a former school teacher, environmental educator, kind of an adventurer. And we've identified both of them as, you know, future environmental leaders. You know, clearly they're going places. And we thought, what a great opportunity to spend 30 days, 500 miles, showing them what we've seen, the benefits, the experiences we've had, but then learning from them at the same time. And at the same time, kind of plotting how can we involve more people like them to, as they take the reins of the environment in the future, to involve them in experiences like this.
Don, what's the route of your trek?
We start at Sandy Point State Park on September 9th, and we travel north to the head of the Chesapeake Bay, cross through the Chesapeake and Delaware Canal, down the entire length of Delaware Bay. We hit Delaware Bay at Lewis, Delaware. At that point, we travel down the ocean side from Delaware into Maryland and into Virginia, come around to the Capes and to the mouth of the Chesapeake, then we paddle straight up the Chesapeake, eastern shore of Virginia, the Lower Bay Islands, Tangier, Smith Island, South Marsh Island, up to Tillman Island, and we cross over back to Sandy Point about a month later.
Wow. Wow, that is... Rona, do you have a question for Don? I'm saying wow, because when you think about it, that is a long... How many miles is that? Do you know what that figures out to be in miles?
I do. It's just about 500 miles.
Okay.
And, you know, it's an ambitious trip. It's not easy to do in the 30 days that we've got allotted for it. You've got to ride the currents. You know, on one hand, you think that, you know, you're going to use your brawn to get around that peninsula. And in fact, what you really do is use your brain, because you got to predict the current and paddle at the right time and be flexible to paddle at night or early in the morning or whatever it takes to get a little bit of a boost along the way.
Rona?
I was really interested, Don, in what you pack for a trip like this and, like, what you need for 30 days of no indoor plumbing.
Well, you know, you pack the essentials. And what's beautiful about being on an expedition is that you realize that, you know, sometimes you don't need that climate-controlled world that you leave behind. You know, you've got a tent that becomes your house. You've got a pad that becomes your bed. You've got a sleeping bag. You might carry even two, because we start in summer, we end in fall. It might get a little cooler through the times. You carry a bunch of different types of of gloves to put on your hands, because your hands are prone to, when they get soft from the water every day, they just are prone to get blisters. That's a real problem. And then you carry a bunch of layers, so you dress appropriately. So, you know, you try to prepare for whatever is thrown your way.
Hey, Don, I was curious what vessel you use for this trek.
You know, I'm using a 19-foot Necky Kevlar boat, you know, which means something to just about two people in the world. But it's a fast sea kayak. And, you know, what is the benefit of sea kayak is that we'll be able to go in places that a normal motorboat would not be able to go. For instance, when we're going down the ocean coast, you paddle right behind the breakers, right behind those sharks that we just talked about, and the porpoises and the migrating fish. But then when you want to take a break or you want to camp, then you go through the surf into the beach. And only a kayak's the only vessel that can do that. So it's seaworthy, it's efficient. But most importantly, it puts you in a proximity to nature and to the water that it immerses you. You're at water's level in a way that you're really part of the environment, not apart from it.
So I have a question for you. One more question. What occurred on the last trip that you hope will occur again? Or something you saw, something you experienced the last time that you hope you'll see again?
You know, I mean, part of it's experience. As opposed to what you see. But the experience to me was, I remember at the end of that trip, as I said, that when I was in an opportunity to be able to paddle the Delmarva Peninsula every year, I would do that every year till the day I died with my friends, because it's such a powerful sense of place. And so I think the experience of being out in the wilderness for 30 days is something that you just can't get anymore, you know, and it's more important than, you know, the last house on Holland's Island that we saw and we're wondering, you know, we know it fell down, we're curious how the island went. The house that we stayed 4 days in or swept away by the rising sea, we're curious what's left of that island. Those are important, but more importantly is the cumulative experience you get by being out in nature for 30 days.
Don, thank you, and good luck to you.
Thank you, Dan. It's a real honor, and I'd love to invite people to participate. You can go on our website at upstreamalliance.org, and we've got a daily update on Instagram, blog, Facebook, Twitter. And you can get the pleasure of joining us on this trip without having the pain and the blisters of actually being on it.
If paddlers actually wanted to join you for part of the trip, could they meet you at certain places?
Yeah, we're inviting people for weekends, so contact us up by the website. And, you know, we're taking up to five people that are able to paddle 25 miles a day and love to have them.
Upstream.
And I'd love to have you, Dan.
Okay, 25. I don't know about 25 miles a day.
I already invited Dan. I hope you don't mind.
I'm going to be fishing for rockfish down on Pratt Street. I mean, it's upstreamalliance.org, right?
That's correct.
Thank you again, Don, and good luck to you.
Thanks, Dan.
Yeah.
Thanks for being on the show.
Yeah, we should check in with him in a month or so. We'll take a break here, and then we're going to check in with Patrick Hudson, who's oyster farming in the Chesapeake Bay. And Rona brought him in to be with us in the studio. So a short break. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Midday on the Bay with Rona Cabello of the Chesapeake Bay Journal, and now with Patrick Hudson, who's farming oysters in the Chesapeake Bay. Patrick's in the studio. He brought some of his oysters with him and something to drink along with the oysters when we consume them when we get off the air. Looking forward to that. Oysters on ice here. Patrick, nice to have you on the show.
Great to be here.
How do you trade as? What is your oyster outfit called?
True Chesapeake Oyster Company.
True,
the name of the farm.
Right.
Yes, sir.
And how old are you, Patrick?
I am just turned 29 plus one. I don't want to say the actual number. But,
okay. Yeah, it happens to the best of them. happens to all of us.
It's a bummer.
So how'd you get into this? I note here that you graduated from Gilman, so you're from the Baltimore area?
Yeah, and I just want to say, you know, long-time listener, first-time guest.
Excellent. Nice to have you here.
My mom and my sister are huge fans of you.
Oh, right.
As well as myself, and just I'm a nervous wreck right now.
Did you recruit your mom and sister into the farming yet? You know, it's a family business.
Oh, yeah, yeah. They've come down to the farm for sure, sorted oysters and helped us with the harvesting process just like Rona did.
Yes, I did it for a day.
Did you?
Yeah. So
where is Patrick's place?
It's down in Ridge, Maryland on St. Jerome's Creek.
I know where that is. Southern Maryland, right?
Which is historically a wonderful place to grow oysters. There's a historic record that the oysters of St. Jerome Creek were something to behold. And in the 1800s, the federal government even undertook a study of this area because the oysters were so nice there. And one of the reasons for that is because oysters need a really nice, precise mix of fresh and salt to get a really good taste. And where that line is, I think you call it the 38th line of the where the parallel, is like a really nice mix. Hmm. So and Patrick runs an excellent operation.
Well, tell us how you got into this. Hey, Gilman, what year?
Graduated 2004.
And went to UVA?
Yes.
University of Virginia.
Wah-wah.
And what were you thinking when you graduated from Virginia? You weren't thinking about oyster farming, were you?
No, not at all. I actually went to Brazil and lived down in Sao Paulo for about a year working for a law firm and came back.
Did you speak Portuguese?
Yes.
Do you still speak Portuguese?
Si.
Excellent. So, okay, so you did that for how long?
I was down in Brazil for a year and came back and thought I would study for the LSATs and
go to law school.
Go to law school, make my mom proud. And ended up going down to St. Jerome Creek one day, and I was just really, you know, taken by the area, and met a gentleman named John Lohr, who was an older guy in his 80s, and he just said this was the best place to get oysters back in the heyday. And there's actually a museum in Solomon's Island that's kind of dedicated to him and the Lohr family. And so I thought it'd be really cool to kind of pick up on that tradition. And I got some fantastic business partners up here in Baltimore.
Oh, wait a minute. How'd you go from visiting a museum to there's a little leap there
right.
you made for me. So how'd
right.
you, what made you say, well, you know, I think this is for me? Because, you know, I've been to the Whaling Museum in New Bedford, but I don't think I'd become a whaler, you know.
Right. Well, you know, I had spent the last year in an office and being outside on St. Jerome Creek and trying to figure this whole thing out, how to raise a good oyster, just was very exciting.
Was someone already doing some oyster farming in the area?
Sure, yeah. There were a couple of farms down in southern Maryland as well as on the eastern shore that were oyster farming. And I visited those farms, and I visited farms in Boston and in Maine and in Canada and in South Carolina, and tried to learn about what they were doing and what might be able to apply in St. Jerome Creek in southern Maryland. And,
so it was the conversation with Mr. Lohr that got you thinking, maybe I could do this?
It got me thinking that the oysters in St. Jerome were something that were really special and really unique. And I thought, wow, wouldn't it be cool? You know, when I first visited there, there were zero oysters in the water. And now they're over 8 million. And we're
just in the creek?
Yeah, just in our farm.
Okay. And, so there was some oyster farming going on, but not in that area.
No.
But in southern Maryland, but not there.
No, there were no oysters in the creek when we got there.
Did you buy property?
We did.
So you bought property, and that's where your operation
is? Mr. Lohr's property, yes.
Oh, you bought his property?
Yes.
Oh, this gets very interesting.
Okay. He's still a close advisor of the business and is helping us on our way.
So it's waterfront property?
Yes.
And what does your operation look like? Could you describe it for our radio listeners?
Rona, you want to take a shot?
Okay, go ahead. You do
sure.
that. What's it look like, Rona?
So you go down to the end of sort of a small two-lane or more like a one-lane road, and there's a dock. And underneath the dock, it's a covered dock, and that's where Patrick has his cages and boxes, and it looks to be a small operation. It's just kind of the footprint of a dock. But then in the water, there are buoys, and if you pull up the buoys, there are cages. So a passerby wouldn't necessarily know, oh, that's an oyster farm, because on some oyster farms, they raise them in floats, so the floats are on top of the water. Patrick's are underneath the water, so you can't see them. You see buoys, but you don't see floats. So it's a beautiful location, and there's a house where the manager of the farm, Tyler, lives, and he pretty much runs the day-to-day farm, and Patrick is down there a couple days a week, also getting his hands dirty and muddy. And
why do some farms have the floats, and why are some farms such as yours, where all the aquaculture is underneath?
It's just a different way to raise an oyster. In our case, St. Jerome Creek is so beautiful, and there's some really nice houses, and folks there just really want to retire and enjoy the creek and enjoy life there and all the recreational opportunities. And when I went to the community with the idea of building a large-scale, you know, commercial-scale aquaculture company, between the floats, which you can see, and the cages, which you can't see, the community really wanted us to do cages, you know, kind of out of sight, out of mind.
Right.
And we've done everything we can to blend into the community and at the same time really sell a lot of oysters. And we just a couple of months ago sold our 1 millionth oyster.
Holy cow, we're well on our way. It's in how many years, Patrick?
We've been selling the oyster for a little over 2 years. The first one I ever sold went to the Preakness in 2013.
That was after how many years of getting established?
Well, it takes about 2 years for the oysters to grow. So I put the first oyster in the water down there in 2011.
And the types of oysters that you raise and harvest are historically connected to the bay?
Yeah, there's actually only one type of oyster, one genus of oyster on the entire east coast of the United States, the Virginica. And what makes a Virginica different, whether it's a blue point or a skinny dipper, is where it's grown. So you
brought in with you skinny dippers and huckleberries.
Correct. Yeah, the huckleberry is our cocktail oyster, and the skinny dipper is a nice bay oyster, three to four inch.
They're all from the genus of Virginica.
Yes.
Okay. So, and these have been raised elsewhere in the bay?
Of them come from St. Jerome Creek. And the differences in size.
I mean, historically speaking, others have grown these, raised these
elsewhere?
Oh,
yes, definitely.
See.
Yep.
And those are all yours from Jerome Creek?
Yes, St. Jerome Creek.
And you said a million, you sold your millionth oyster?
Yeah, a couple months ago. It was a big benchmark.
Who got it? Did you actually see the? was there actually the millionth oyster?
I think we sent it to one of our longtime clients, Riley's Oyster Bar, down
in
Federal Hill.
I know that place.
Yeah.
So how are you doing with this? I mean, you say it's successful. Are you making money?
Yeah. We've got 7 employees now. They all make money, which is great. it's really good to provide jobs for some really great people.
And how do the neighbors feel about it down there in Ridge, Maryland?
I think for the most part, they're supportive. Like I said, we've done a really good job blending in with the community. I think if you ask our neighbors, they'll agree with you. But I think there's also, some general misunderstandings out there about oyster farming. And, you know, people might think, oh, it's going to be a big commercial business in this beautiful area. But in reality, we're growing oysters, they're filtering the water, they're improving the environment, and we pull up cages, and sometimes we found a seahorse in a cage once. I mean, I didn't even know seahorses existed.
I don't know, seahorse in the Chesapeake Bay.
Yeah.
Right.
So the animals, the ecosystem, they love what we're doing, and our neighbors are definitely coming around and being supportive as we grow.
Have you had any cow nose rays try to get into your cages?
We love the cow nose rays. They're our buddies. and they can smell our oysters, but they can't get to them.
Yeah. I was going to say, there's a remedy for the cow nose rays. Raise oysters in a cage.
Right. And that's why there was a big oyster farmer in Virginia who complained that he had to invest close to $1 million in oyster cages because the cow nose rays were getting his spat on shell oysters. And Patrick doesn't do spat on shell. He does the single oyster that's the more expensive oyster. And so those oysters are going to be in cages or floats, whereas the sort of traditional Chesapeake Bay farming where you just put out shell and put out spat, that's like a very nice appetizer for a cow nose ray, especially if it's small.
So when you start, you're starting with what?
A 1 millimeter oyster. You can fit 10 of them across the face of a penny.
And that oyster, 1 millimeter oyster, needs how long to be ready for Riley's?
About 2 years.
About two years. Some are faster.
Yeah. Fast growers can get there in almost 12 months, 14 months. And some of the slow growers take a little bit longer than 2 years. They all grow at a different pace.
Patrick, I appreciate you coming here today to be in the studio with us. I just wonder, what would you normally be doing this time of year, this time of day?
We would be working on the nursery in the summer when the water's warm. Those baby oysters, the 1 millimeters we were just talking about, they're growing and they're in tanks. And my operations manager, Tyler Sonberg, he's busy at work down at the farm right now with our 6 other employees, getting things done. And increasing the amount of oysters that we have to sell.
Well, that's excellent story. Go ahead, Rona.
I just wanted to say that Patrick might be too modest to mention it, but he has the official oyster of the Maryland State Fair.
Oh, really?
Coming up next week, right?
Yeah, it's actually the Maryland State Racing. We're gonna bring between 30,000 and 40,000skinny dippers and huckleberries to the fairgrounds in a partnership with The Local Oyster, which is a catering company that my partner and I started. And we're actually going to get a brick-and-mortar spot coming up here in the new Mount Vernon Marketplace at 520 Park Avenue. So look for that opening up on October 7th.
No kidding.
Yeah, we're really excited about it. It's going to be our very own oyster bar.
What building is that? Is that the old medical arts
Herschel
building?
Cone.
It's old Herschel Cone?
Yeah.
Herschel Cone building?
That's it, yes.
What's the address again?
520 Park Avenue. It's a brand new marketplace with about 15 vendors. And
and you say it was a Herschel Cone building?
Yes.
Once upon a time.
Once upon a time.
520.
Now it's going to be the spot of the best oyster bar in town.
And what's it going to be called?
The Local Oyster.
The Local Oyster. How much time do we have left? We only have 30 seconds left in this hour? Oh, that's a shame. Oh. Anyway, I'm sorry.
Wait, can I crack my beer then?
Okay.
It's been done.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Sorry, FCC. We already did it.
The true Chesapeake Oyster Company?
Yes.
Patrick Hudson, thank you very much. Congratulations,
right.
Patrick.
Beers and oysters with Dan. Coming up.
Coming right up while you listen to the news. That's what we'll be doing. Thanks, Rona.
Thank you, Dan. Thanks so much.